Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Heck, president and founder of the International Association of Teamwork Facilitators. Today is Wednesday, January 13th, 2016. This is our first call of the year. You've dialed in or you're on the web. And today's event does include the opportunity to view a web interface. So if you're listening to this recording, you'll hear me mention this a couple times, and there are opportunities for people to ask questions through the web interface in the chat feature. You can find that at uberconference.com/TomHeck. A little bit about the IATF. All of our work here is designed to do one thing, and that is grow inspired teams. And we do that through monthly events like this, and then group and one-on-one coaching. We have an online community of facilitators, coaches, trainers, educators from 35 countries, and also offer on-site workshops. So you can find our website at iatfconnect.com. And now about our guest today, Dr. Ernie Gundling. He is the co-founder and managing partner at Apurion Global, which is located in the Oakland area of on the west coast of the U.S. And his company works with people in 60-plus countries, and they have to be able to manage 15 different languages with the people that they are serving. Dr. Gundling assists clients in developing strategic global approaches to leadership, organization development, and relationships with key business partners. He coaches executives with global responsibilities and works with multicultural management teams to help them formulate business plans. He has lived and traveled extensively in Asia and Europe, including 6 years in Japan and a year in Germany. He is currently a lecturer at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. And Dr. Gundling holds a PhD and a Master's of Arts from the University of Chicago. Got someone from Chicago here on the call today. And then also a Bachelor of Arts from Stanford University. Welcome, Ernie Gundling.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I've got a variety of different materials that I'd be very happy to share with you today. And I thought that some of the topics we might cover would include what's changing or what's shifting in the world and why we need to pay attention, because there's always the question, each of us only has so much time in the day. And so the why should I care question is important, and I'll try to address that. And then I think looking at some specific implications for global teams and how we would manage them or run them is also important. And so I'll look at some topics where I think some very specific changes are occurring, including the world of outsourcing, as well as what people need to do in addition to good facilitation and project management, as well as the world of diversity and inclusion. So we'll spend some time talking about each of those topics.
Perfect. So tell me, where was the center?
Well, there's a charming academic in the UK who's actually done a whole series of calculations, and he put the economic center of the world, according to his calculations, 15 years ago in the middle of the Atlantic. And now it's shifted thousands of miles to the east. And his calculation is that within another 15 years, it will be the economic center of the world will actually be between India and China. So there is almost a literal shift that we can calculate, but I'll try to also talk about other dimensions of what's going on. So I think most of you are familiar with Thomas Friedman and this idea that the world is flat. And Friedman actually wrote a subsequent book called Hot, Flat, and Crowded. So he took the theme and added the crowded part as well. And certainly from a technology standpoint, the explosion of mobile devices and access to the internet has been remarkable. And you've now got 4 billion people out of 7 plus billion on the planet who have access to mobile devices and social media sites. It's quite remarkable. We in the San Francisco Bay Area here work with Facebook as a client, and as some of you may have heard, there are over 1 billion users of Facebook. So there is a sense in which this connection across borders and across traditional boundaries is very much the case. And whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Google or any of the other technologies that are out there, there's certainly an explosion of this kind of connectivity. And I like this phrase, continuous partial attention. And you can see that the U.S. has got most of its population connected, but in already the connected population, India is double that, and then China is triple that. So it's quite remarkable, actually, how this connection is occurring. And at the same time, in addition to the flat and connected part, there are some major changes that are occurring of other kinds. So if we go back to the mid-1950s, which is when I was born, you can see on the left side of the chart, the ratio of the green to brown was about 1 to 1.5. So the more developed countries, which are the green, were about roughly 1 billion, and the less developed countries were about 1.5 billion. And so we had 2.5 billion people on the planet. In my lifetime, just in the course of my lifetime, we've actually tripled that. So now we're at about almost 7.5 billion, and we're scheduled to add a couple of billion more. And I think what is important to keep in mind is that that green line, the developed world, is remaining relatively flat. So virtually that entire additional 7 billion people that we're adding to the planet is coming in the developing world. And that just represents an earthquake, a real huge and important change for all of us, which I think will have implications in a variety of different ways. So one specific implication of that is that 90% of the world's children under the age of 15 are currently in emerged or emerging countries. So that means our team members, our customers, our employees, our business counterparts, our competitors are primarily in this emerging world. And just to be a little more specific about some of these trends, so we've tripled the population already just in the last 60 years. We've got 2 billion more people coming. We've got a huge shift from rural to urban. So we've got 370 more cities which are being built at a vast and daily scale. We've also got most of the world's GDP growth between now and 2050. So the next 35 years will occur outside of the markets that we're perhaps most familiar with if we're from North America or Europe. And then finally, we've got this huge middle class, which has been developing very rapidly, again, outside of Europe and North America and Japan, the former, what was formerly known as the developed world. We have a lot of these emerging market countries, which I think you have to say, at least in some part, have emerged already. And so some of this vocabulary that we used to use about developed and developing and immersed and emerging is also changing as we speak.
So did you write your book for people living in Europe, Canada, and the U.S.?
Well, we tried to do both. We tried to write it for people who were based in North America and Europe, and to acquaint those folks with some of the changes, but we also tried very much to write it for emerging leaders. And with many of the clients that we work with, really one of their key demographics and certainly counterparts that many of you will find, whether you're in a commercial organization or working in a government organization, you'll find that the organizations that you work with are very much committed to developing local talent and local leadership. And so we've also very much included a number of examples from emerging market leaders and tried to tackle in an even-handed way both some of the issues that they face as they try to themselves lead teams or to participate in teams in an effective way at the same same time that we're talking to people in the developed world who are working with this emerging set of counterparts.
So, and I don't want to go too far off of your slide deck. I know for all of you listening, let me tell you, Ernie has way more information than we can share in 1 hour. But so from a leadership standpoint, have you found that there tends to be one type of leadership that works well globally, or does a leader now who grew up in a North American culture have to learn multiple leadership styles, or is that even a concept that, am I incorrect in that? And that there's lots of different leadership styles, they're all over the world. We now need to be able to be fluent in all of them.
Well, I think there are as many different leadership styles as there are people. And when we work with global leaders in our work, we have to very much focus on both what is authentic for them. There's a lot of debate and discussion these days around the notion of authentic leadership. And some people have unfortunately taken it as an excuse to mean, I am who I am, and I'll be that person wherever I go in the world, and I won't change or adapt, and other people have to learn to deal with me, and that's not a very effective or constructive approach. But on the other hand, you can't be somebody else. You can't be who you're not, and so we talk about adaptive authenticity, which means I am who I am, and I have a comfort zone, but I also am willing to try other things. I'm willing to adapt. I'm willing to look at local practices and try to understand what's most important, and certainly to motivate people in ways that are important to them. So, you know, we're looking at a slide here on China, for example, the volatility of the market in China and the way that people move between companies and the expectations they have around promotions and career advancement, the fact that you've got all these one-child families and now these one-child family children are in the marketplace and have been catered to by six adults their whole lives with two sets of grandparents and their own parents. I was just talking with someone in a client organization in China last night, and he was saying that these folks are very impatient and sometimes they're not great team players, and so their expectations for career advancement and promotion are off the charts in terms of what he's used to in a North American organization. And at the same time, part of his job is to accelerate their development and to empower them and to make them part of a team and to help them communicate effectively with the rest of the world. And so there is this, I think what's crucial and the key answer to your question, Tom, would be there's a premium on agility or flexibility and self-awareness and the ability to recognize both who you are and what the environment is that you're in, and to be able to frame shift or style switch, not in a way that takes you way out of your comfort zone, but in a way that leverages your talents as a team leader or as a team member.
So how do we do that? And now I'm thinking more macro here, Ernie, is our, and I'm also thinking in North American terms,
sure.
Is our culture set up to develop leaders to be agile and flexible?
by our, who are you, which hour are you speaking of?
Well, here in the U.S., so I'm thinking, you know, I've got a 12-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son, and I'm looking at your work and thinking, you know, when I was 12 or 16, this was not a topic of conversation, you know, of a flat world. You know, the market was pretty easy to understand. And so, does our system here in the U.S., and maybe you have an opinion about Europe or Asia, is one country raising their children to succeed in this environment better than others?
Well, I think Europeans have traditionally, because their borders are much closer to one another, and they're in a crossroads geographically, I think there's been more international consciousness and experience through the educational system and through one's early experience in life than has been natural in North America, which has been a continent of its own and has, at some points we've had an isolationist tradition. We've thought that we've got some oceans that insulate us from the rest of the world, and so we're fine on our own. But I think increasingly it's obvious that that's not the case. And speaking for our own situation here in North America, and specifically in the United States, I think it's very spotty. I had my youngest son was in a school that up until eighth grade had no foreign language, but now he's in a high school that actually offers Chinese. And I think we have some school systems that make international experience a priority, and others that don't. Tonight he's got to draw a map of Russia, and a couple of weeks ago he had to draw a map of Africa. So I think there's hope. I think schools are changing, but it's very spotty, and some districts, it's the strength and weakness of our educational system, but some districts make it more of a priority than others. And frankly, I think some are still in the dark ages, and others are very progressive.
So what about Asia? When the time that you've spent in Asia, is this a topic of conversation about global leadership?
In Japan, for instance, where I live, the word international or internationalization has been around for a long time. Now they have their own both very progressive and also backward ways of looking at it. But I certainly know that the elite, which we see in the corporate world, and also I see them in the class that I teach at Berkeley in the business school, they're as good or better than any of the U.S. students. And certainly I had a Chinese student this last semester, for example, who had been grown up in China, was going to business school in Hong Kong, was now a visiting student at Berkeley, and was interested in going into the Chinese venture capital world, and he was a star in operating in another language. So, and we've got superb students from India and elsewhere. So I think the bar has definitely gone up, both in terms of the corporate world and also in terms of what our kids will be running into in college.
Well, I know that you have some other slides to share with us, some other ideas, and I do want to point out to everyone that you have the ability to ask questions over in the chat window area of the website. So please take this opportunity to make a comment, to ask a question, and this is a great opportunity for you to ask one of the smartest people on that I know of when it comes to working on a global team and leading and even understanding this. You've got an opportunity to ask a question right now, so please take advantage of that. So Ernie, I guess back to your slides. I didn't want to go too far off of that.
Yeah, sure. I wanted to suggest one tool in response to your question for thinking about how can I adapt and work in practical ways with members of my own team or with other counterparts throughout the world? And this is a tool called the GlobeSmart Profile that we have in my company. We've had over 1 million registered users now, so we've got a ton of data and good validity and reliability. And what we found is that there are very significant differences between individuals and between cultures on these five dimensions. So are you more independent, or are you more interdependent or group-oriented? Are you more egalitarian? That is, do you assume that not only that the technology of the world is flat, but also that organizational hierarchy should be flat, or are you more comfortable with status and that kind of hierarchical differentiation? And then do you focus on risk or restraint or caution? Are you more of a direct communicator or a more indirect communicator? And then finally, are you more task-focused or more relationship-focused? So over the years, we've built a database, and we have various country averages. But I think also what's particularly important, and this is an example, I've removed the names, but these are several members of the same team. And I think you can imagine, as a very practical step for a team leader and thinking about, okay, I can't jump out of my skin and be somebody else, but I can certainly adapt to some degree. And if I have this difference, so let's say I'm the team leader in red, and I have a very egalitarian attitude towards the world, and I've got some members of my team who are more status-oriented, that's going to affect the way the assumptions that we have about how decisions should be made or how tasks should be allocated. And likewise, if I'm more interdependent on that top dimension and some of my team members are more independent, I might assume that it's a good thing for all of us to work together to solve problems, but I've got some team members who would prefer to have something delegated to them and just go out and solve it themselves and bring it back when they have a solution. So there's some, I think, very practical ramifications for each of these dimensions. And I think one step that any team leader can take is to, first of all, get a profile of the team on these different dimensions of culture. So you're not thinking so much about nationalities, although those national differences are important and sometimes are reflected in the individual profiles that you see. Typically, the Asian countries, for instance, are more of an over on the right of the scale. The U.S. and Australia, and to some extent the U.K., are towards the left, and much of the rest of Europe is in the middle, just speaking very broadly in terms of these dimensions. But even something like task and relationship, there's not a big gap for these three team members on this score at the bottom. But when you do have a big gap among team members, there's even a question about how should you start a meeting or how should you start a team, get a team going to begin with. So do we start by just launching right into the task, or do we start by getting to know each other and then moving on to the task? So I think each of these has important implications, including if you've got a number of indirect communicators on the team, for instance, there's a whole art to drawing them out and trying to make sure that they're included in very practical ways.
Hmm. This reminds me, Ernie, of I was once working with a first-year class of MBA students at a, I'm not going to mention the university, but the college, I'm going to guess that everybody would recognize it. And we were all of these students were broken into teams of four. And one of the tasks that they were completing was they had four quadrants on a sheet of 8.5 by 11, and they were doing some artwork of on each of the quadrants. And one was, you know, that had to do with how you view our team, this small team of four, right, that where they were going to be working with that year. And one team I'll never forget had three, it was all young men, and three were raised in the United States. One was visiting from Japan. And it was sort of it was comical now listening to you because the three from the U.S. had variations of a flag on top of a mountain or an eagle flying over it, essentially saying, we want our team to be the best and to stand out. And this other person from Japan had a hammer hitting down nails so that they were all even on a board. And so they all shared what their artwork meant to them and what it was communicating. And essentially, the three from the U.S. had a different view of, you know, we're going to stand out. And this person from Japan said, well, what I want to do is blend in to, you know, to become part of the team fabric. Is this, does that strike you as odd or probably fairly normal?
No, there's a famous Japanese saying, as some of you may know, that the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. So he was illustrating that saying and also illustrating this dimension of independent versus interdependent. So Japan's very much over on the interdependent side of the scale. And so he didn't want to be the nail that sticks out. And by the way, an interdependent team can be very effective, and also a team that has both types can be effective if the team leader integrates and deals with this in a conscious and effective way.
Well, we've got a question from Lauren, and she asks or states initially, I provide leadership development training to corporate teams. Do you have any tips on providing training to teams with international members where cultural differences are present? I.e., I've noticed U.S. and European participants are much more verbally engaged in training than Asian participants. What tips would you have? Well, and specifically, I want to again encourage folks to look up "Leading Across New Borders." This Ernie's book is on Amazon, and you can also go to the Aperion website to take a look at that. So, tips for Lauren.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I'll go back to that direct indirect dimension, because you're talking about a team where, and we see this very often in our work, where the North American members will be very direct and vocal. In fact, I've sat on the Asian side. I remember sitting in an office in Shanghai on the other end of one of these conference calls, which was scheduled at a convenient time for the folks in New York, but it was 10 p.m. for us in China. And the folks in New York were talking with each other and looking at things on a board. They were drawing things on a board that we couldn't see. And they forgot, basically, that we were on the other end of the conversation. And I could just see, looking around the table, that Chinese members of the team were so alienated by this process. And when they did try to get in, often the members of the team on the U.S. side would talk over them and go back to talking among themselves. And there were even side conversations that we couldn't hear very well. So all of those would be examples of not such great practices. I'll go back to the deck here, and I'll pull out a couple of suggestions for team meetings here. So here's a set of best practices for virtual team meetings. Get people to identify themselves and address other speakers by name, modify speech. If you're the team leader and you see someone engaged in a monologue, you definitely have to try to work with them to stop that. I would say use techniques to deliberately include people from other locations. Have a way of using open-ended questions, which tend to get a better response than yes-no questions. Often an indirect speaker will just simply say yes because they want to be polite and agreeable. But using an open-ended question, which would mean instead of can you do it by January 30th, an open-ended question would be, when do you think is a reasonable completion date for this project? So that allows them to then get into the conversation in a more effective way. And so among other things, I think these kinds of lists, if they're really enforced by the team leader and become part of the fabric of everyday team meetings, can be quite useful.
So let's go back to that. And Lauren, let us know if that was helpful. Ernie, go back to that situation where you were using the technology, or just from the technological standpoint.
Sure.
Is there any technology that would have helped, or was that just all, was the problem primarily human?
Well, so let's think a little bit about this technology issue. I think when we're involved in these large-scale virtual teams, we tend to assume that we can have a strong project management process and some really good communication tools, and we'll get great results out of that. Here's an example that we've dealt with. This happens to be Rick on the left, based in the UK, and the Indian team leader is Bhavesh, second from the, or third from the right, second from the left on the Indian side. And so this is a fairly typical team where Rick's done his best to set it up. He's got a virtual relationship with these folks, and he's frustrated because he has asked some not very open-ended questions and has gotten positive responses, but isn't getting people who are able to meet the deadlines that he thought were clear and agreed to, and is very worried about whether this project, which is part of his metrics, is going to be completed on time and within budget. So Rick's got pretty good technology. He's got pretty good project management, and we can think about some of the specific things that he could do from a facilitation standpoint. So certainly, if there's budget, we've always found in our research that having a face-to-face kickoff meeting would be a good way to start, because you can find out more about the circumstances. Not just throwing things over the wall, that tends to be a problem in working with your virtual team counterparts, as they feel like second-class citizens and that they're just playing a bit role when they increasingly what they really want is end-to-end responsibility and the opportunity to be team leaders themselves. Rick can set, as a good project manager, tightly spaced milestones. He can check in with people. He can schedule one-on-one conversations with Bhavesh, for example, to make sure that Bhavesh is able to talk with him without losing face in front of his team members. And then he can do some of the other things that we've talked about around cultural differences. But even that's not enough. We find often that in this kind of team setting, that people are pulled apart by separate reporting relationships and metrics and different customer demands and so forth. And what we've often found is that, and this was the situation with Rick and Bhavesh, is that all of this tends to produce a downward spiral of lack of trust and sometimes doubting the competence or the integrity of the commitment of the other parties on the team, and the distrust tends to be mutual. And so beyond the technology and beyond the these facilitation best practices, what else can a team leader do? One of the things that we've done over the years is also to collect data from more than a couple thousand, more than 2,000 teams, and with a large number of team members. And this is a model, I won't spend a lot of time on it, for the survey that we used, but the items that have consistently emerged over time as the most problematic for teams are related not so much to the process or technology issues. They actually tend to think that they're pretty good on the virtual technology and the management of it, but actually it's more getting into these more fundamental systemic issues. So whether it's the reward system or getting cooperation from other parts of the company, the metrics and whether they really reinforce teamwork, as well as resolving problems together and combining that face-to-face with virtual communication, those tend to be some of the more systemic issues. And what we found is that many of these teams are influenced by the matrix organizations that they're part of, and that these different matrix priorities pull people in different directions. So another set of suggestions I'd have would be that both Rick and Bhavesh together step back and ask themselves, do we have executive sponsorship? Do we have buy-in from the matrix stakeholders? And actually, as it turned out in this case, Bhavesh is reporting to a local Indian manager, Manish, who's giving him different priorities and different suggestions, and is saying, well, you can spend 10% of your time on that work with Rick, but really this mm-hmm. other local project that we're working on is more critical, and that's a key bottleneck. And so I think in addition to the technology, in addition to the facilitation, it's important to step back and say, is this matrix team set up for success to begin with? And can we get affirmative answers to all of these questions? Because if it's not, then Rick probably needs to go back to his own management and say, I don't think this team is set up for success, and how can we turn it around?
So, Ernie, do you please tell me you've got the in your book the list, the checklist of how to set up a successful team.
Well,
here are the 10 steps you need to take.
We do actually. There's a whole section of the book which is on team startup or team setup, and I can't cover the whole section at the moment.
Sure.
But we really do try to ask this question because we've seen so many good team leaders struggle in this matrix context where there are circumstances that have set the team up for trouble, and mm-hmm. Where it's really important to step back. And so we think it's really the question is, how do you create this combination of these fundamental team practices, the team, what we call team foundations, and that's partly what this section of the book starts with. How do you go about establishing trust? How do you really get things off in the right direction, going in the right direction? And then beyond that, how do you also make sure that the team is set up for success in a matrix context? And that's,
right.
I think, pretty crucial as well. And when that piece is missing, there tends to be problems.
We've got a question from Rachel. She says, the author of The Culture Map distinguishes between direct and indirect communication versus sharing direct versus indirect negative feedback. Let's see if I'm reading that correctly. Direct and indirect communication versus sharing direct. Rachel, you might have to clarify this in the chat there. Have you found any support for this distinction in your research?
Describe it again. Say that again.
Yeah, Rachel, you might have to help us here. If you could write your question a little differently, but she says, are you, the culture map differences? Oh, she writes differences between indirect and direct overall communication versus, and she's, typing in now. Let's see. It looks like it's, indirect and direct overall communication. Oh, there we go. Versus negative feedback given directly or indirectly. Does that make sense, Ernie?
I think so. So first of all, The Culture Map is a fine book. Erin Meyer, the author, is a colleague. She actually worked with us for 7 years and then went on to teach at INSEAD and has been continues to be a very helpful colleague in many ways. So I'd encourage those of you who are not familiar with the book to have a look at it. And what Erin does is she takes that direct, indirect dimension, which I showed you a little bit ago, and breaks it out in a little more detail. And what we'll find in some organizations or in some countries as well is that direct versus indirect communication is very situation-based. So it's not correct, for instance, so I lived for 6 years in Japan, in Japanese in general are indirect, famously indirect, but it's not correct to say that they're indirect in all circumstances. So when a Japanese boss is giving negative feedback, he will actually often single out the one of the most promising subordinates and will yell at him in a loud voice, yell at the subordinate on the team, give him very pointed feedback, and do that in a public setting. And So there's hierarchy there. As a boss, he's allowed to do that. And there's also, so there's this very direct and vocal and sometimes loud component to it. And by the way, there's a fair amount of direct feedback in many Asian cultures in social settings as well, in which the hierarchical relationships are less pronounced. But this direct negative feedback has both this this very pointed element to it, but also it's indirect in the sense that everybody on the team understands that he's actually somewhat honored this fellow by singling him out for punishment, and that the message is to the team as a whole. And so there's this indirect component to it as well. So direct and indirect is complicated, and it's not only the way the message is conveyed, but also are we, as the receivers of indirect feedback, able to perceive that someone's gesture or their posture or the way that they said yes actually meant no, or the fact that they're silent has an affirmative or a negative meaning, depending on the way that they're silent. So there's this art form for reading indirect feedback as well that's part of this mix. So I think what Aaron has done well is to break out this notion of direct versus indirect and to note that there are several different dimensions to it.
Great. So, so she writes, how do those kinds of differences show up in your algorithm or profile on the five scales, or do they?
Well, so we try in order to keep things straightforward for teams that are just getting started. I think Aaron's got 8 or 9 different dimensions, which can get kind of complicated. We stick to 5, but we have questions in the direct versus indirect dimension that look at both the way that communication is transmitted and also the way that it's received. So we try to look at both ends of that spectrum. And so we sometimes have people who will say, well, gosh, I thought I was a pretty direct communicator, but my profile is more in the middle of the scale. And what we tell them is that, well, you probably do convey messages relatively directly, but it's also an indication that you probably are perceptive when it comes to indirect messages, and therefore, instead of being fully at the direct end of the scale, you're more in the middle. So there is that nuance to our dimension. But if you really want to break these things down, we have some colleagues who are proud of being able to talk about 50 different dimensions of culture.
Well, I see you have a slide up on virtual team meetings and setup. And these are some, some best practices.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a taste of some of the practical steps that you can take when you've got a virtual team. Certainly this team photo, making it clear who the facilitator is, getting the agenda out to people, especially second language speakers, so that they can prepare in advance is very critical. You can often get far better input when you both shared information in advance and you've also solicited input from them. And then we often get the question about how do you deal with different time zones. So until we have the Star Trek solution of the transporter or the hologram, I think share the pain is the main principle, so that it's not just us doing it at a time that's convenient for me, but I think when others are participating in a meeting at a time zone that's very inconvenient for them, acknowledging that I've got one of these at 5 or 6 in the morning tomorrow, and I'll feel much better if at least the person on the other end acknowledges that it's a ridiculous time.
Well, we're getting close to the top of the hour, and I want to encourage everyone else to share your thoughts or questions over here in the chat window. I have one final question for you. I'm just going to plant this seed, Ernie. It's about innovation, and where do you see what's becoming innovative in the world of leading teams that are spanning the globe you know, where is the innovation coming from and how do we enhance innovation? Just this whole idea of innovation. But before you go there, maybe we can take one more question from our audience here today. And this is from, I think, Tess, who says, Dr. Gundling put up a circular diagram earlier. I was unable to catch the detail. By the way, we're going to share Dr. Gundling's these slides here today. We're going to get those up on the IATF website so you can see them a little better. But she goes on and says, can you share it again? It had a whole lot of nice colors in it. Dr. Gundling, you shared that with me yesterday and mentioned, I think it's slide 23 there in your deck.
Yes.
Yeah, and you related this to the forming, storming, norming, performing sort of sequence that teams go through.
Yeah, so this is a model that we use as the basis for a 42-item survey that's focused on global team performance. So in terms of very practical tools that you can use, I think that something like that GlobeSmart profile, and there are a variety of different options out there. We happen to think that ours is very user-friendly and has a strong statistical background. But then once you've got the team started up and you have some awareness of the similarities and differences in the profiles of people on the team, you want to look more specifically at team performance. And so this is a model for doing that. And you'll see the four blue dimensions around the circle, team foundations, conflict resolution, team process, and team performance. Those are somewhat analogous to the good old forming, storming, norming, performing. So those are part of the model, although the items are all worded for global teams, so working in this multicultural virtual context. Mm-hmm. And then there's an additional key dimension that's focused on cultural diversity, and we can talk about that a little bit in the remaining time that we have, as well as looking at both face-to-face meetings and virtual communication, which is very important in this context. So these are the seven dimensions that go into the survey, and it's we found it's a very effective tool for both working with team leaders, if you're coaching a team leader, and also if you're working with team members. And these five items, I'm sorry, I went through these rather quickly, but these five items that I shared with you are the lowest scoring items. There's a lot more data. We've, you know, got highest and lowest and priorities and so forth, but these are the ones that over this very large database teams have struggled with the most over time. Mm. And so these are ones that I think are important for a team leader to really think through and to look at systemically. Another piece that we look at in the book are also the priority items. So these are the key weaknesses that team leaders and team members have identified over a very large set of data. And in addition, we look at the items that they've identified as team priorities. And those include things that we might take for granted in a domestic team, like, for instance, clear roles and responsibilities, one item that emerges as a priority. But what we find in this global context is because things are virtual, because you've got this very dispersed multicultural group, that it's important to go back to these foundational areas and to revisit them and to establish them in a very solid way so that you've really got the foundations right. We call it creating a strong container for the team, because without that, particularly in this global team context, things can really go awry.
Mm. Well, we're almost at the top of the hour. If you could share, look into your crystal ball and tell us what is on the horizon. What do you see coming down the pike for those of us who have an interest in working in this arena, global teams?
Yeah, let me say a little bit about this area of inclusion, because I think it's pretty important. And I know that many people, particularly here in the U.S., shudder when they hear the term diversity, because it tends to be associated with some at least for some of us, rather painful forms of training that we feel like we're doing our best to practice those skills already. But I think that issues around race and gender are critical, will be with us for until the end of time, and are important on a global scale. And what I would encourage people to do as you look at your global team is to think even more broadly, so not only about race and gender, but also looking at, for instance, if we look at the faces on this team, we might assume that this team, this happens to be an Asia-Pacific team, is not very diverse. But there are forms of diversity which actually may be interregional, or somebody grew up in a rural background and somebody grew up in an urban background, or someone's from a first-tier city and someone's from a third-tier city, or someone has more global exposure and someone has less. And so I think looking at not painting a country or a region with a broad brush, but rather looking more specifically at individuals who may look alike from the standpoint of race or gender, for example, but also understanding the differences between them. And just an amusing example to share, we're running in Silicon Valley into a lot of client situations where actually the gap is between tech and non-tech teams, and the tech people will think that the other guys are illogical and fuzzy and so forth, and the non-tech people will think the tech people are socially inept and self-absorbed and black and white. And so I think as we go forward in response to your question, Tom, just thinking in this more nuanced way about all the aspects of how we can be really inclusive team leaders, and in this truly inclusive way, leverage in the spirit of innovation, all these different ideas and perspectives and voices, because we see more and more, for instance, I was just talking with this about a client earlier this morning, this imperative to make a good enough product at a price that people in emerging markets can buy, and which maybe is different from the way that we positioned ourselves in the marketplace before, but it's essential if we're going to position ourselves effectively in India or Indonesia or other parts of the world that are these key growing markets. And it's only with the diversity on this team and really leveraging that we can actually figure out that equation and not end up with the Tata Nano, the $2,000 car that famously caught on fire and ruin the brand of the car, but rather something that consumers can buy, that they will enjoy, that they will appreciate, and which is at a quality and a price point that is good enough for that market. So that's a key innovation challenge going forward.
Wow. All right. So I want to encourage everyone to get over to Dr. Gundling's website, which is Aperion Global. And I'm going to spell that out for you. It's APERIANGLOBAL, APERIANGLOBAL.com. And of course, head on over to Amazon if you want to take a look at the book, Leading Across New Borders, How to Succeed as the Center Shifts. And Ernie, I know that we had talked yesterday with you and some of your team members about a special offer. Is that something that we would like to talk about now, or shall I send that out after when we have the recording ready?
Sure, we can. Why don't we send it out as a follow-up piece? But we just wanted, as a courtesy to those of you on the call, and a thank you to you for participating, offer you free access to that GlobeSmart tool with the profiles for a couple of weeks, so you can check it out and see if it's something that would be valuable to your team. And we're all, we have lots of global teams within our customers and our client set, as well as within our own company. And so we're learning along with the rest of you and have tried to share some good ideas and some best practices that we've collected from others. But I'd love to hear any additional ideas or best practices or feedback that you might have. So feel free to contact me or contact us, and we hope that we'll have a chance to connect with you in other ways down the road.
Fantastic. Well, and I see here in the chat window, Nicole has posted the link to Aperion Global and also the link to the Amazon, so you can all take a look at the book. You can see if you'd like to get Ernie's or contact him via email. That slide is up right now, but it's egundling@aperionglobal.com. We'll make sure that all of this information is posted on the IATF website, and I'm going to be sending out a broadcast letting everybody know when this is up. Should be up within about 48 hours or less. And so, Dr. Gundling, Ernie, thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous, and you've got so much information. It's clear that there's a lot to learn from you, and I'm really delighted that you have this book. I'm holding it right now, and let me tell you, folks, this is, how many pages are it? 232 pages of resources and ideas, and this is coming from an organization that spends their day thinking about these topics and working with people around the world. So tested. So thanks again.
Well, thank you, Tom, for the opportunity. I admire you and the organization and what you put together here. And we wish all of you who are running and facilitating global teams, we wish you lots of luck and hope along the way that some of these resources will be useful to you.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for being here, everybody. Really appreciate your time. And please be on the lookout for the recording and the slide deck and the other offer to exactly how to access the resources that Ernie and his team are making available to us. So thanks again, everybody. I look forward to talking with you soon, and have a great week.